Hello. On this week's program, as fragments of an unfinished Sibelius masterwork come to light, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns considers whether we're about to hear a new Sibelius symphony, more than half a century after the death of the great Finnish composer. Susan Lewis explores the best of times and the worst of times in the life of Charles Dickens. Celebrations of the 200th birthday of the great English novelist are taking place around the region and the world. And as the Kimmel Center celebrates its 10th birthday, we speak with Anne Ewers, the president and CEO of the Philadelphia Regional Performing Arts Center. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Though it's only a snippet of music, Philadelphia orchestra goers will know immediately who wrote it, the great Finnish composer John Sibelius, whose music has been core repertoire for the ensemble since the Ormonde years. But if the piece itself is impossible to place, it's because it was only heard for the first time in Helsinki this fall, when sketches for the composer's long-in-progress but never completed Symphony No. 8 were played in a few isolated fragments by the Helsinki Philharmonic Orchestra. But can scholars finish an opus that the composer could not, or should they? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spoke to sources both in Finland and closer to home, and emerged with no assurances that the Sibelius Symphony No. 8 will ever be heard in full.
Music scholars are always in search of the great lost symphony, the end-of-life piece that could sum up everything previous and go one step beyond. Gustav Mahler, Edward Elgar, and Anton Bruckner have all had their final opuses finished by others, often to great acclaim. The Symphony No. 8 occupied John Sibelius from 1927 on, though all the world heard was 30 years of silence ending in the composer's death in 1957. During that time, he proclaimed the 8th Symphony to be nearly finished and even scheduled a premiere date in 1932 with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, only to change his mind saying, "I've had all sorts of interruptions, please don't advertise any performance." It is believed that he finished the symphony maybe several times in different versions, burned it in the mid-1940s, and possibly started over. So, where is it? Helsinki music critic and Sibelius scholar Vesa Sieren got wind of other scholars who had been sifting through the composer's papers and found orchestrated fragments for the 8th Symphony. Sieren arranged to have the Helsinki Philharmonic play them. What was it like to first hear the piece that had defeated Finland's greatest composer?
My hands shook a little, and the woman next to me, who is a publicist of Helsinki Philharmonic, started to cry. And it was a historic moment, because for so many decades we have imagined what it could have been like. Was he searching for some new style? Was it something like Seventh Symphony? Was it something entirely different? The harmonies are quite bold. And when I heard the sketches, I realized that he knew exactly what he was doing. The sound world was genuinely Sibelian, but also a Sibelian in some new, previously unknown direction.
The excerpts were recorded and posted on the website of the newspaper Helsingin Sanomat, where Sieren is employed. Opinions differ as to whether the piece can be completed. The surviving sketches are thought to have been made early in the piece's gestation, but there are 800 pages of them. Scholars are often wary of jumping to grand conclusions. Sieren and others gingerly describe the sketches not as the 8th Symphony, but as something dating from the period of the 8th Symphony. Even orchestrated fragments heard here are what Sieren calls close contenders. One scholar, however, has said that the 800 pages are mostly the same piece, and the symphony is indeed finishable, and you never know what unknown materials might show up that could bring the two scholarly sides closer together. Sibelius hired a copyist named Paul Vogt to translate his script into something that working musicians could read. and Siren spoke to the copyist's descendants.
Her granddaughter actually phoned to me and said, okay, we don't have symphony number 8 in our attic. But 2 hours later, she phoned me again, saying that actually I looked more closely to my late father's belongings, or how do you say, and I actually found 5 letters from Sibelius to Paul Voigt. And so after 2 hours, she found these. So I'm still hopeful that maybe after some more weeks, someone somewhere gets interested and might find some more.
What could it have been like for a composer of Sibelius's stature to burn decades of work? Vesa Siren is 2 degrees removed from a near eyewitness to the event, having interviewed Sibelius's grandson, Erkki Virkkunen, who arrived at the family's homestead one night in the 1940s to discover his grandmother, the composer's wife, Aina, to be quite upset.
And he asked, what has happened? And Aino Sibelius said that there has been a great bonfire here, and she was totally shocked. And Grandpa, Jean Sibelius himself, he didn't make a big thing out of it, seemed more a subject of humor than anything. So he was not satisfied, and he was very upset of the idea that people like me might actually publish something. So he thought that his Symphony No. 8 is not worth to be published in that form, so he burned it.
Some have speculated that the bonfire was the composer's way of restarting the symphony with a clean slate. Certainly, the piece was still on his mind, says Siren.
In early 1950s, when he was a very old man, he said that, okay, it's ready in sketches, but I haven't had the power to actually write it through. So there's a contradiction there, or is there? Is it even possible that he continued to sketch out the symphony even after he had burned it?
What could have been going through the composer's head as he held back the symphony time and again? At that point, Sibelius was very famous. He had a reputation to live up to. He didn't need money. Also, his hands had begun to shake so much that his wife would forge his autograph. One thing that seemed to decrease the shaking was alcohol, something that Sibelius struggled with much of his life. But Siren is almost defensive when it is suggested that alcoholism was a factor in the symphony's unfinished state.
It was usually so that when he worked for months, all day and all of the night, and when the masterpiece was ready, then he thought that, okay, now I'll party so hard, and so he did. But the thing is that if he were what we call alcoholic, that drinks every day lots of alcohol, he wasn't like that. And in 1930s, he mainly stayed at his home where the wife was there all the time, and he certainly didn't want to be, how do you say, drunk as a skunk every day.
As high as the curiosity factor is for the Eighth Symphony, it's hard to know how much conductors are willing to deal with a fragmentary work. When the Philadelphia Orchestra's music director designate, Yannick Nizet-Séguin, heard the 3 bits posted on the internet, he was more amused than intrigued.
I think the last excerpt has the most naive quality. But, you know, I'm in split minds. I think for musicologists it's great, but I also think that we have sometimes the deleted scenes in DVD, and it does fulfill our sense of wanting to know everything about something, but this feels very much to me as great ideas he had, sketches, but many composers had these, right? And Brahms burnt them all, and maybe...
maybe he had the right idea?
Yeah. Do we really need another symphony that we will try to assemble? Will that help the case of his legacy, Sibelius? I'm not sure.
I disagree, if only because we never know what doors will open, what acts of creative clairvoyance are possible once the right scholar is engulfed in page after page of the composer's manuscripts. The Elgar Third Symphony was considered to be a hopeless case, even as fragments were played over the BBC. But somehow, those scraps turned into a fully-fledged symphony in which the composer's voice is loud and clear. So the Sibelius Eighth is still worth a try. I'm willing to bet that if the completion doesn't work, our ears will tell us immediately, just as they told us in these tiny fragments, that this was Sibelius speaking in a way that we'd never previously heard, just as he spoke to us in his great, great Seventh Symphony.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Whether I will turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show.
So begins David Copperfield, said to be the most autobiographical of Charles Dickens's works, written from 1849 to 1850 when he was in his late 30s. But Dickens had been chronicling his observations for more than two decades and would continue to produce work for two more. His novels and short stories about life in 19th century England have survived and thrived. Dickens's life and work is the subject of museums and festivals, among them last week's annual Dickens Festival in Narberth in the Philadelphia suburbs, and a year-long celebration of exhibitions and programming now in progress at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Oliver and Great Expectations are among his works adapted for stage and screen, and of course performances of A Christmas Carol are now standard fare, with the bah-humbugging Scrooge now part of the vernacular. February marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of this literary giant, and now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the man behind the words.
Today, even people who have not read the novels of Charles Dickens are likely to have seen his work on the stage or screen, which might have pleased the man who at one time wanted to be an actor himself. His great-great-grandson, actor Gerald Charles Dickens, has delved into his grandfather's life and work.
He loved acting, he loved performing, he loved being on stage, he loved going to the theatre and watching other people perform. And when you read the novels with that in mind, you can see the theatricality behind him, the way he sets scenes, the way he develops plots, the way the characters are drawn and described and how they act.
Charles Dickens became famous for his colourful characters and dramatic scenes, often set on the gritty streets of 19th century London, conditions he experienced firsthand as a young boy.
A lot of his writings are based upon his life.
Siobhan Reardon is president and director of the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Much of it is almost autobiographical in some ways, shapes, or forms. And so almost in every single story he writes, there's some part of Charles Dickens and his life in there.
Dickens was a master at drawing readers into his stories.
He develops his character well. He develops his scenes well. He writes dark and he writes epically, but he does add a tremendous sense of humor to his work.
The library, which boasts the third largest collection of Dickens letters in the world, has worked on its exhibitions with LaSalle University literature professor Edward Pettit, who says Dickens found inspiration in his surroundings.
He would walk around the city at night and visit all the bad neighborhoods of the city and use all this personal experience he had within London and the surrounding countryside on his vast walks. He would walk miles a day. 10 miles a day was nothing for him to walk. You know, there's not only literary influences on his work, but I guess I would have to say the biggest influence on his work is the environment that he lived in, that his environment shaped what he wrote.
He grew up in circumstances that exposed him to good times and bad. The second oldest of eight children, Dickens was born in 1812 to a middle-class family. But when his father, a clerk in the Naval Pay Office, landed in debtor's prison, 12-year-old Charles was sent to work for a time in a blacking, or shoe polishing, factory. Janine Pollock, head of the Free Library's Rare Book Department, says the experience made a lasting impression on him.
And gave him a sympathy for the poor and for people who had to work for a living. But eventually his father was able to pay off his debts and Dickens was then sent to school. He started to learn shorthand, so he was taking notes at Parliament and writing for this journal that, you know, said what was going on in Parliament, and that's how he got his start as a writer.
His first big foray into fiction was in 1936 with sketches of everyday people, including schoolmasters, shopkeepers, criminals and the destitute, as well as young gentlemen and ladies. Writing under a nickname he'd given his younger brother, he published in different journals and then collected the pieces in a book he called Sketches by Boz.
They were a slice of life. They were everyday life and everyday people, he called it. And, you know, London was pretty gritty at the time. So some of the descriptions are, I'm not going to say vulgar, but just very real, raw, funny, some of them.
Later in 1936, Dickens was hired to write captions for a series of illustrations. The captions expanded into stories, and when the Pickwick Papers was published, Dickens' writing career took off. Next came Oliver Twist, the story of the misadventures of the orphan Oliver, where Dickens began his literary advocacy for the poor. Oliver was followed by Nicholas Nickleby, The Old Curiosity Shop, the historical novel Barnaby Rudge, and others. He wrote nearly all his novels in parts, serially for monthly journals. Edward Pettit says while some cautioned that he wouldn't be taken seriously as a novelist in that form, his writing became enormously popular.
People really tuned in every month for the next issue, and it affected the way he wrote. Especially early on, he was not plotting ahead of time these novels, especially Pickwick Papers, but even Oliver Twist. You could tell he's writing it serially. He's just thinking it up on the fly. But it also adds this great energy to it. Like, the story really moves because of that.
A Christmas Carol, said to have been written at odd moments, appeared in 1843 and sold 6,000 copies on the day of issue. It became the first of five annual Christmas stories. Despite the pace of his work, Dickens created complex and quirky characters and gave detailed instructions to illustrators as to exactly how these characters should look.
Some people say there are 989 named characters, and he really gives them a personality and gives them all of these idiosyncrasies.
The description of Scrooge is a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, and by the time you've got to the sentence, you're him.
Gerald Charles Dickens travels with a variety of one-man shows based on his grandfather's life and works.
The great thing about Scrooge is everything is so direct and so harsh. So when he's in his office on Christmas Eve and his nephew comes in and wishes him a Merry Christmas, he says, "Christmas! Out upon Merry Christmas! Well, what is Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills with no money, a time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and bedded with a stake of holly through his heart. He should."
Dickens' characters had their own followings. When Little Nell, a 13-year-old orphan in the Old Curiosity Shop, hovered between life and death.
Everyone was so wrapped up in Little Nell's story that, especially in Philadelphia and New York, when the serial publications were coming across on the boat, people were waiting at the docks for the next issue to come out to find out, did Little Nell make it? Is she going to live? And of course she didn't. And people were very involved with these characters.
The character of a raven in the book Barnaby Rudge, about a mentally disabled man, captured the imagination of another literary giant, Edgar Allan Poe, says library president Siobhan Reardon.
Poe didn't think that the raven in Barnaby Rudge was very well developed, and so that's how Poe came to write the raven. The raven, of course, Grip, was the household pet of Charles Dickens.
Grip was stuffed when he died and now lives at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia, along with over 1,200 letters Dickens wrote, his desk, and a dozen personal effects, which lend insight into his busy personal life. Married in 1836, he had 10 children and also took care of extended family members. Dickens traveled to Europe and the United States. In 1842, he made a stop in Philadelphia. In his American notes, he wrote at length about the horrors at Eastern State Penitentiary. About the city itself, he observed,
"It is a handsome city, but distractingly regular. After walking about it for an hour or two, I felt that I would have given the world for a crooked street."
Over the next 2.5 decades, he would continue to turn out literary masterpieces, among them David Copperfield in 1849, A Tale of Two Cities 10 years later, and Great Expectations in 1860. He worked to raise awareness of social injustice both through his writings and with philanthropic support of institutions like a hospital that served the poor. And in 1858, he started his reading tours in England, touring in America in 1867.
He would prepare for them. He would almost rewrite the story. We even have a copy of one of the Christmas stories that is edited for reading.
When he went on the road with his reading tours, it was a way to have a very direct relationship to his readers. The very famous one, he never did over here, but did in England, was The Murder of Nancy from Oliver Twist, which was so brutal and so graphic in the way he performed it, even though he was standing at the reading desk with a book in his hand in white tie and tails. But it was so convincing and so graphic that he used to judge the success of the reading by the amount of people who fainted in the audience.
Dickens died suddenly in 1870, leaving his last book, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, unfinished. Sculptor Frank Elwell, unaware that the author had directed in his will that no monument should be created to honor him, cast a full-size statue of Dickens with his character of Little Nell that now stands in Clark Park in West Philadelphia. But the greatest tribute to Charles Dickens is this. His novels and short stories have never gone out of print and continue to be read, adapted, and performed today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Free Library of Philadelphia is celebrating a year of Dickens. The exhibition, From the Desk of Charles Dickens, is in the Rare Book Library and includes letters, manuscripts, personal effects, and Dickens' stuffed pet raven, Grip. It runs through May 25th. Character sketches from the world of Charles Dickens is at the West Gallery at the Central Branch of the Free Library through March 23rd. Ten years ago, the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia opened to much fanfare. Conceived as a regional performing arts center, the building promised a long-awaited new concert hall for the Philadelphia Orchestra with state-of-the-art acoustics, a home for some of the city's other major performing arts organizations, and a venue for touring groups. Commonwealth Plaza, its large ground floor space between Verizon Hall and the Perelman Theater, was envisioned as a lively public space, a kind of indoor town square. But when Anne Ewers arrived as its new president in 2007, the Kimmel Center was saddled with problems. A $30 million construction debt still loomed, along with a need for funds for capital expenditures and a larger endowment. The vision for a public plaza had never quite materialized, and the acoustics in Verizon Hall had fallen short of expectations. Today, things are looking up. This year's PIFA celebration, the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, brought thousands of people through the Kimmel Center's doors. The construction debt has been retired, a stagehand strike just settled this fall, and President and CEO Anne Ewers, armed with a new master plan, is looking ahead.
We are now embarking on several aspects of that plan, choosing those things that we felt would have strongest impact. So right now, construction's going on to enclose in glass Hamilton Garden so that it can be used year-round.
This is the roof of the Perelman Theater.
Yes, so that that can really be a space for the community to use for receptions and parties and just feel that this is their home.
Weddings in big demand, I hear, for that.
Oh, absolutely. 1,000 inquiries a year. And now we'll have summertime in which we can have those happen. And then moving the restaurant down to the plaza level will just be huge, with an entrance from the street so that it can be open lunches and dinners and regular hours. And again, vibrancy for what's going on. I'm thrilled to say that we spent with Threshold, wonderful acoustical company from Chicago. Again, spent over a year with them, with the members of the Philadelphia Orchestra, all of us listening and tuning and modeling, and then did some of the work last summer and the majority of the work this past summer. And you cannot imagine how thrilling it is to hear the difference.
The other work that you talk about, the idea of bringing the restaurant down onto the foyer into the Commonwealth Plaza. Does that mean that at this point the idea of that being a community space has been all but abandoned, or do you still want people to wander into the Kimmel Center?
No. It's apps. In fact, we're doing more free in the plaza between now and New Year's, and then we'll have free in the plaza for each weekend all the way through June. So no, we are actually taking the success of PIFA. PIFA had 177,000 people going through the doors of our plaza over a 25-day period. So we want to take that success. We've analyzed what pieces worked, what made that possible, what made that happen, and now we're carrying that through for the balance of this season and beyond. So no, we want this to be an active space. We want people to feel that this is home, that this is a place to hang out, and we've got Wi-Fi, and we've got, you know, food and beverage, and wow, this is the place to come and be. See a performance, hang out after, hang out before, be here.
Do you think that at this stage, 10 years down the line, that the Kimmel Center has lived up to the expectations of the people who planned it and of the city that hosts it?
You know, it was interesting in talking with a number of my friends who live in the Washington, D.C. area, and they often remind me that it took 25 years for the Kennedy Center to be everything that folks had envisioned it would be.
Or even break even for that matter.
Well, exactly. And I think that at our 10th year anniversary, we've accomplished a great deal. I think there is much more to be done, and I think the founders are thrilled with where we've come, but we have much further to go, and we're excited about doing that.
What now is the state of the relationship with the resident companies? Because there have been some bumps in the road. The orchestras making noises about wanting to renegotiate. Some fractious union negotiations recently with the stagehands. All of this plays into what you do. How do you feel about the relationship both with the resident companies and with the other people who work alongside you to make this place work?
You know, I really have to applaud the efforts of everybody as it relates to our resident companies. We've worked very hard and have completed five-year lease agreements with new ones, with the Chamber Orchestra, with the Chamber Music Society. Very, very excited about those relationships, some more collaborative efforts that we are now going to engage in. We have negotiated two-year lease amendments for the opera and the ballet to provide them with some important rent concessions. We're in our second year of those now, and so we'll want to look further going forward. We're in discussions now with the orchestra. We are the home of the resident companies. Their health, their vitality, all of us are connected, and it's very important that we support each other. We were built as the home of the resident companies, so it is an important relationship that isn't just a transactional one, if you know what I mean.
You're not just their landlord.
No. We're giving and sharing and doing far more on both sides than would be expected in just a tenant-landlord relationship. And that's how it should be. That's how it should be.
And how do you hope that will manifest itself in the future? Or how will that be improved in the future?
I think already some wonderful things that we're seeing with the Chamber Music Society as an example. We're now going to start partnering on a series together. So those are collaborative ways we can support. Our IT business services many of them. Same thing with Ticket Philadelphia. So it's what can we do together to support each other, to help each other, to make things easier and more accessible and more exciting in serving our community.
And I said final question, but this genuinely is the final question. What were the lessons that were learned from the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts? Because that all was all about the Kimmel Center being the core or being the catalyst for interaction between different arts groups. Have lessons been learned from that? Is that now being applied to the way you run the place?
You know, the exciting piece, well, many exciting pieces, but the collaborative aspect, what's been so wonderful is to see groups that came together for the first time because of PIFA, and they're now continuing those collaborations with other projects, or other groups having seen how collaborations work and finding new ways of collaborating. And that, to me, is so rewarding and so exciting. I think we learned certainly from PIFA that people do want to come and be here and make this a part of their everyday lives. As you know, our vision is transforming lives daily through the arts. And I think that PIFA put us another big step forward in that. And I think our community is indeed coming and reaching and having us reach to our community to help transform those lives.
The Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, President and CEO, and yours. The center's Free at the Kimmel 10th anniversary celebrations have just begun with an 11 a.m. Ukuleles free concert targeted towards preschoolers at 1:30 and 5:30 this afternoon. There are tuba Christmas concerts featuring 100 tuba players performing holiday classics. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.